Let's get started then in this work session, and appreciate all of you being here. I'll turn it over to Commissioner Saltzman to set the table for this discussion.
Thank you, Mayor. Thanks, Mayor, and all of the council and our guests for being here this morning. And I'm looking forward to this work session, and hopefully we'll all gain something from it, as well as our partners here at the table and the viewing public. In council, and when we adopted a budget, the council included a budget note that was entitled Medical Response Services. And it says that council directs Portland Fire and Rescue to reconsider the city's role and potential reimbursement in regards to emergency medical response, including medical response services operating under a city supervising physician. Portland Fire and Rescue shall report its recommendations in a council work session prior to December 31st. So that's what we're here today, is to report on the work session, or report on the budget note. Chief Jansons will quickly run through a few slides that explain the current lay of the land and how Portland Fire and Rescue has been responding to this dynamic area of healthcare. And then we'll open it up to questions and hopefully a good dialogue on how we can make Portland's residents healthier and safer while also saving everyone money. So Chief Jansons, please introduce yourself and your invited guest and take it away.
Excellent. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm Aaron Jansons, Chief of Portland Fire and Rescue, and I have with me Ken Burns, who is our battalion chief assigned to the Emergency Medical Services section in Portland Fire and Rescue under training. I have Dr. John Jew, who is the Multnomah County Emergency Medical Services Medical Director and also serves as Portland Fire and Rescue's Physician Supervisor. To my right, I have Lisa Turley, Director of BOEC. And across from me is Daryl Knott, sitting in for Joanne Fuller. And Daryl, can you tell us your official role?
The County EMS Administrator.
Thank you. And Randy Lauer, who is the General Manager of AMR, the Transporting Ambulance Services, in contracted through Multnomah County. Okay. So I thank everybody for their time, and I actually thank Council for this work session. Portland Fire and Rescue has been busy for the last year and a half, actually, trying to move these initiatives forward, doing a lot of research, actually doing research nationwide on a very, very select group of departments that are currently working to be the leaders in this. And we believe that Portland Fire and Rescue is right on that leading edge and moving things forward in both EMS and healthcare reform. So we're happy to be part of the solutions for national healthcare reform. We are going to just slip through about seven slides and talk a little bit about EMS in Portland. And I'll probably do a very high-level overview, and that will, as Commissioner Saltzman stated, provide a lot of opportunity for detailed discussion with the subject matter experts at the table. So, as you know, Portland Fire and Rescue, we provide advanced life support services as well as firefighting technical rescue from every fire station throughout the city. As far as advanced life support, with 42 units responding throughout the city, 38 of those units are advanced life support. And as Portland's population grows, so does our call volume. So in the last 4 years, our call volume of emergency medical services calls has grown actually 11% since 2009-10. Multnomah County, they are the public health authority, and they coordinate the 911 transport services within the county. They have medical supervision and oversight of the ambulance service agreement, and they contract for the ambulance service provider as well as with Portland Fire and Rescue for first response services. They also manage Portland Fire and Rescue's cost recovery for medical services, so they provide us reimbursement for all of our ALS training, our medical supplies, and quite a bit of equipment also that we utilize for advanced life support services to the citizens. And then they have a separate intergovernmental agreement with both Portland Fire and Gresham Fire. AMR, the private ambulance service provider, they've been with us for 20, how many years, Randy?
Well, originally Black Ambulance.
Uh-huh. Okay, a long time. Okay, all right. But how long have you been the sole provider of ambulance?
1995.
Okay. I thought it was mid-90s. Good.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Yeah. They AMR staffs somewhere between 15 to 25 ambulances each day, and we have a very strong partnership. I would say we have a stronger partnership with AMR than we have ever had before. We do joint training with them. We operate under all the same protocols. It's a very efficient system, and we appreciate their partnership. With the Bureau of Emergency Communications, that's our single point of dispatch. They're a great partner. They've been very responsive to all of the changes that we've had to adapt to with protocols. It's been a very nimble process. We meet with them regularly and really are thankful for that partnership with BOEC. And then obviously we have the other partnerships we have are with the local hospitals, of which there are over a dozen just in the metro area. And hospitals typically, as everybody knows and refers to, that perverse incentive of only having reimbursements or only being able to seek medical care for people who are uninsured in the emergency department. Those are the issues that we're starting to change and that we're trying to address here. We're also trying to just address some of those previous incentives. It's going to take education. It's going to take a concerted effort between all of the partners to help move the system forward and find other more cost-effective measures to improve both medical care to the patient and reduce overall health care costs. So that's a real positive for us. Talked a little bit about the perverse incentives, healthcare reform, the EMS system transporting too many patients by ambulance to emergency rooms that don't necessarily need emergency care. That affects patient care with lack of patient history, lack of continuity of care, lack of follow-up for more holistic patient care to address the underlying issues, many of them social, substance abuse, potentially housing, mental health issues. So fortunately, healthcare reform has shifted its focus to more appropriate, less costly care with improved patient outcomes. So our efforts in Portland Fire and Rescue have involved regular meetings, and I'll say we've been meeting every other week, twice a month, and spend considerable time trying to both research and be solution-oriented for Portland Fire and Rescue and for the citizens of Portland to provide better care. As I mentioned also, we work regularly with BOEC, and Chief Burns and Dr. Ju have both done considerable outreach to our local hospitals and clinics in the region. So with that, we are on the edge to improve healthcare outcomes, forming the partnerships that are required with the providers and the stakeholders to meet the triple aim of healthcare. That's ensuring people receive the right care at the right place at the right time. The benefits, in addition to improved healthcare outcomes for the patients, and we believe that is our number one goal, but we believe we can help reduce healthcare system costs to produce savings for patients, providers, and insurers, and then create reimbursement opportunities to help Portland Fire and Rescue first responder costs and offset some of those. So the alternatives we've evaluated was we looked into ambulance transport. And given that AMR has a contract through 2018, that really limits any options in the very near term. The mid to long term city providing ambulance transport we have identified may not be financially sustainable and could potentially actually place city funds at risk. And that is due to significant startup costs, capital, personnel, vehicles, quarters, administrative overhead needed for insurance, patient billing, collections, et cetera, and then the ongoing staffing costs. And I think Randy has done some research and actually has some more actual data on that. But if you look at salary, city benefits, healthcare, whatnot, our costs are significantly higher. So there's also the very ambiguous thing of an uncertain reimbursement model. Reimbursements are changing depending upon the type of insurance provider and what's provided on the healthcare exchange that people may be signing up for. those reimbursement models are changing dramatically between private, Medicare, and we don't know what the future holds for those. So that's going to be a very competitive environment that may, again, end up shifting costs and may cause the potentially, if we took over transport, could end up requiring the general fund to subsidize that type of issue. So we're trying to be very open, and we're watching that very critically. We also looked into city supervising physician. So currently, Portland Fire and Rescue contracts with Multnomah County for the services of Dr. Jew as our physician supervisor. That places Multnomah County Health, Portland Fire and Rescue, BOEC, Gresham Fire, and AMR all under consistent medical and joint training protocols, which is a very efficient system, especially when we go about trying to change any type of protocols or be responsive. I think the recent Ebola, I wouldn't call it the Ebola,
situation.
Okay, we can use that. But because we had one physician supervisor and medical director coordinating that, we in Portland were really on the leading edge of developing our protocol and being able to respond effectively and efficiently. And I will tell you that we've been contacted by numerous other agencies outside of Portland wanting our protocol and trying to figure out how to implement that when they've got two or more physicians competing for their own perspective and different take on how to implement those things. So it really, really allows us to be much more nimble. And those are some of the downfalls, obviously, is that when you have two or more physicians, you're going to have different opinions and things become a little slower to implement. With that, with our programs underway, we have a frequent caller program, or actually we're updating the term for that, and it's called the high utilizer group. So it's a HUG. And that is for, with a partnership with the county, they have brought on four social workers who we refer to when we have a high utilizer patient. And that is somebody with either three or more calls in a month or six or more calls to the system within a six-month period. We can refer them to the county, and the county will follow up on those individuals and try to identify any type of underlying issues that are causing them to utilize the system more frequently and ultimately try to get them better care. And that could be addressing any mental health issues, housing, substance abuse, or simply making sure that they're seen at the same provider and get that consistency for patient care, which is really important. Three a month or six in 6 months.
And Lisa Tully, could you tell folks the names of the staff who would do that work at BOEC? Because I know we started it when I was in your commissioner, and I was very impressed with those folks' ability to be able to get that data.
Right. We have a computer system that goes through and looks at same addresses. And we look at that, and then we have a couple of people in our research department who go through each one of those incidents and look for the text of the call and what was going on. And we identify people who are using, we're doing this primarily for mental health, but it could also be used for, I think fire and AMR are tracking their patient names, but this is for callers who we don't know who the names are. So we go in and by hand go through probably 60 calls a week and figure out the people who are high utilizers of mental health.
To give a shout out to the particular staff.
Yeah, our researchers.
So the high utilizer group program, sorry to interrupt the flow, but had to key on this, which is it addresses both physical health frequent callers and mental health frequent callers.
Correct. Daryl, would you like to speak to it for a minute from the county's perspective?
Sure. Mayor.
No, you don't have to push the button.
Okay.
Sorry.
Very good. And council, the 911 frequent caller program is a tri-county program that is funded through CMS through an innovation grant. We have four social workers that work in the EMS office, and referral data comes from each county, and we prioritize those patients, and then the social workers contact, do research on medical records and data, and then, as the chief said, redirects them to appropriate levels of care, does short-term case management.
And what is CMS?
Sorry, Centers for Medicaid and Medicare Services at the federal level. So the grant is in its last 6 months and ends June 30th.
But it has been a very successful program, and I believe just in the last year, 70 patients were referred, and I believe that 50 of those patients are no longer identified as high utilizers. Is that accurate?
From
our data that we have. So they've made a significant impact on those for those callers. So.
And I also just want to mention, in case anybody's concerned, that we are very aware of medical confidentiality issues, and so oftentimes the information sharing is one way that the medical providers don't necessarily let us know who is getting the good outcomes, but they can give us the summary data.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like we as non-medical providers are meddling in folks' private business.
Thank you for clarifying that. Another program that we've been working on for quite some time, and we are actually concluding it, we started it last November 2013, is the Alternative Destination Alternative Transportation, or the ADAT program. We launched that last November, and that was a program to identify when we went on the lower acuity calls, responding with the RRVs, and identified any patients that currently at that time were uninsured, and we had a partnership with HealthShare where we could identify that they didn't need to be transported to an emergency department, but they could be transported to a clinic and or be seen, but not necessarily need to be transported by an ambulance. And so therefore, it would help to reduce the overall costs and help keep them out of the most expensive system. We learned a lot from that program. It was very successful, and we are building on that, and actually just signed a LOA with Local 43 to begin a second pilot. We're calling it ADAT2, where we are expanding the number of companies involved, and we are expanding the number of clinics involved, and believe that we're very optimistic that it's going to be a positive program to help people get to the appropriate care, the right time, right place, and help the system overall reduce the cost of health care and get them. Yes, Commissioner.
Chief, how many people actually have been taken to alternative destinations under the pilot?
And can you speak to that?
Yeah, it was a Multnomah County, Clackamas County joint pilot. 30 individuals were sent to alternative destinations, 24 of which were from Multnomah County.
So that's 30 people out of a call volume of how many thousands?
Do you have that number?
Yeah, well, our EMS response is roughly 52,000 in an annual year.
So these were calls that were deemed and triaged as lower acuity calls that the RRVs went on. One of the challenges is that this is a completely new concept, and so we were limited by clinic hours, and we were also limited by educating the patients on seeing of this different alternative. And so oftentimes, patients would decline it because it was something unfamiliar to them. I think that in the future, as we move forward and we get more information out to people, we'll have more opportunity to convince them or to share with them just the opportunity and to make good choices on scene.
Do we have statistics on how many people were offered that option but rejected it for the reasons you just gave?
Yeah, that was the kind of the catalyst for ADAT too. Some of the hurdles and obstacles that we're looking to overcome is increasing the pool of potential candidates. Medical, from our folks in the field who are currently doing ADAT 1, the medical criteria which shows us that we would have about 15 to 20 people each month that would meet the medical criteria. Now, when we take care of adding different insured eligibility, we increase the hours, then we'll increase the amount of trained members doing it. And those were some of the obstacles that we think that in ADAT 2 we'll be overcoming.
Mm-hmm. So while we signed an LOA for a six-month pilot with Local 43.
Say what, LOA?
Oh, I'm sorry, letter of agreement with Local 43. I see this really as a step, and that while Chief Burns and Dr. Ju have worked hard to develop relationships with local clinics to get people seen within their own neighborhood, where I believe this is going is that this will be a provider-wide or system-wide opportunity that we can simply have a number and find out once you are connected to Providence or Kaiser or Legacy or you're uninsured, we can make one phone call, let your provider who has all of your information determine which clinic we should send you to, and then we have a cab sent and we are able to get the patient transported to the appropriate clinic. But again, there are many steps in solidifying those relationships, getting that developed system-wide so that we can do that citywide, and also educating the public about the other opportunities that are available to them.
But just in terms of sort of the pool you start with, which is the people who meet the medical criteria, your estimate is that it's 15 to 20 people a month.
That's actually, it is based on those figures, but only 4 responding units. And we hoped within the year to include all 42 responding units. So the 15 to 20 is with only 4 units participating, trying to get the relationships built, get the processes built, and then expand it to other stations, quite frankly, and include other apparatus.
So do you have an estimate of what the market share of this kind of call is? I mean, is it 5%? Is it 15%? What is the medically?
We think it's somewhere between 6 to 15% of our calls, of our EMS calls total.
Yeah. Okay, that seems reasonable.
And who pays for the cab?
At this time, we've got a contract that we will pay for the cab through this pilot.
And how much is it?
$50? It's $50 for the cab fee for the term of this pilot. We're working on geographic locations with preset fees. So the patients will be already predetermined which clinic they will go to.
So how does that save us money?
Saves the healthcare system money. So what we're looking for,
That's not
what
the job we're supposed to be doing.
Well, what we're looking at is doing this pilot, and then we show providers the outcomes and how much money we're ultimately saving providers, and then we can seek reimbursement from the providers or simply have some type of a stipend that they provide Portland Fire and Rescue to provide these services and keep their patients out of the emergency department when they don't need to be there.
Well, what's their incentive to do so if we're doing it now without having them pay?
It's really a proof of concept at this point. And so many departments, the few departments that are out there doing that right now, many of them started with a proof of concept. And then the providers started to see their patients coming to them versus the ED. And there are numbers that I don't have those off the top of my head, but it's thousands of dollars per patient that it saves the providers. And so there's real incentive to go, okay, this system does work, and we're gonna pay you for helping us make this happen.
And have we had who's been at the table from the providers to express interest in this?
You know, we haven't had official conversations at a table yet. We've had conversations with people underneath, the program managers and whatnot. We have not brought the CEOs in of the providers yet. We want to be very well prepared when we do that. There's kind of one shot to get that, so we want to have data and we want to have kind of that proof of concept wrapped up when we do that.
And when are we thinking that we would be moving the costs to them rather than to the city budget?
You know, I would hope that in the next 6 months we're going to gain some great data and be able to show them savings. So some of the ADAT2 pilot is going to be really critical to gaining that data.
And what was the total cost of the first pilot?
Total cost of the first pilot, I don't think we had any direct cost, actually.
Not direct cost. I mean, some of the impact on the fire bureau, of course, is the training our members with a little bit more knowledge of identifying a lower acuity patient who is eligible for alternative destination. But there wasn't other cost to Portland Fire and Rescue.
I don't think the cabs actually got used in that during that time.
Yeah, and, this, and just to clarify, the first ADAT one, the cabs weren't part of our we didn't carry the water on the cabs. Health Share actually provided the cost for the cabs.
Let me pile on to this line of question, because I'm glad you started, Commissioner. And that is, I bet you and I are coming from the same place here, which is, I'm really glad you've conducted this experiment, that you are conducting these experiments. And I have no problem with the city spending money to conduct R&D. That's what we're doing here. Mm-hmm. That's great. I'm totally supportive. But I think we need to be very explicit about some expectations about change. I mean, the fact that Randy mentioned that we have a 100-year-old system here. And this is going to seem like kind of a bizarre comparison, but I don't think it's that bizarre. And that is that probably it's escaped no one's notice that we're struggling in both lodging and transportation to adapt to the new economy and the impact of technology on very old systems, like our taxi cab system or our system of having hotels where people stay when they travel. The pace of that technological change can easily exceed that of government, and appears often to have done so, at least elsewhere. So there is very rapid technological change happening around this very old system. Secondly, there's this huge change in medical administration that at least I, and I think a lot of people, only half understand the gears that are turning and where we're going as a result of those changes. But no question there are big changes afoot, right? Formation of CCOs and, you know, the Affordable Care Act and all these other enormous changes. I cannot imagine that we'll get, that 5 years from now, we'll still be responding the same way we always have, and that the Portland Fire Bureau will be the only uncompensated partner in the medical system. Mm-hmm. Or at 911. Well, 911 sort of gets compensated because we used to have a revenue system that is based on calls. But I cannot believe that this system, this very old system, right, under the in the huge wind of that technological and policy change, after the wind dies down, that we're still going to have a four-person engine crew and a two-person AMR crew showing up at a medical call. We're not paid. Everybody else in the system is paid, and we're taking 99% of the patients to ERs.
Right.
And so that's why we're here, because we think this change is all around us and that we need to run a little faster to keep up. But I'm totally supportive. But I think we as a city need to be with the legislature, with our partners at the County Board of Commissioners, with the medical system, very explicit in that expectation that the old way in which the city of Portland is the only unpaid partner in the medical system is going away. And it's our job to devise a system in which we are at least partially compensated for the work we do by a medical system that pays everybody else, and that we get patients to an appropriate venue. And I'll talk more about that when we talk about mental health later in this discussion, because that's another place where we're going to have to make deliberate change pretty quickly, because the federal government has told us that we must.
And actually, Mayor, speaking of the federal government, I mean, they're another important partner, because we've talked with people in private insurance about the odd incentives here. They've said that they tend to take their cues in a lot of ways from Medicare. And if Medicare changes the way they do reimbursement for emergency and medical services, that would speed up the pace at which the private insurers would change what they do. So we've talked with Senator Wyden's office about that, which is, I mean, he's in the appropriate place because the Finance Committee has jurisdiction over Medicare, and they're thinking about that as well.
Well, thank you, Mayor. You set up my next slide very well. So let me talk a little bit about programs that we're evaluating now. So you will see that we submitted in the Innovation Fund proposal a proposal for in-the-field treatment, and that is actually utilizing a paramedic who's trained as a community paramedic. It's a specialized training where they're actually allowed to do suturing and some other things in the field that our current paramedics are not. And then teaming that paramedic with either a nurse practitioner or a physician assistant where they can actually issue antibiotics. So we've got, obviously, in probably more in the downtown area than other places in the city, we have a population that may not necessarily want to go to the hospital regardless of whether they have or need care, whether they've got a cut that needs some sutures or something that's going to potentially become infected and require much more significant care down the road if they're not treated. We want to create an opportunity and pilot an opportunity to see if we can make a difference with a population that desperately needs help and give them care in the field where they're resistant to go on, and then see the difference or the impact we can make with that population. So that is one proposal. Another thing that's going on is that telemedicine is, as you mentioned, just the advancements in technology. Telemedicine is, you know, very soon to come to Portland Fire and Rescue, and connecting back to the hospitals, whether it's a lower acuity call to verify with a physician or whether it's a critical call where the physician actually needs some eyes on the patient during a trauma incident or something, that we can actually connect back to the hospitals and provide more visual, and actually the patient may be able to have a dialogue with the physician also to reassure them about the appropriate treatment and potential transport that they may have. So those things are very, very soon and up and coming for Portland Fire and Rescue that we're excited about. Another thing we're real excited about is our partnership with AMR. And we've talked about being very solution-oriented and ways that we can better partner to reduce overall costs in the healthcare system, both for the patient and system-wide. And with Randy Lauer, we did some brainstorming and talked about we already have ALS out of 38 of our 42 response apparatus. If we are able to commit to full ALS response out of every apparatus, they can eventually start to, through attrition, start to trickle down from a 2-medic response on their ambulances to a 1-medic and an EMT, and that will provide a cost savings for them. We can also look at adjusting the clock for AMR on their arrival, since we can provide that medic first the majority of the time. That way they can, again, through attrition, not have to staff up to the same level, and can have fewer ambulances on the street, but still provide that continuity of care in combination with Portland Fire and Rescue. Those two things combined, we believe we can provide a great cost savings to AMR that they can share back to Portland Fire and Rescue up to $1 million a year. So that's a significant revenue source that would come into the city, into Portland Fire and Rescue to help support the services.
Just explain to folks what you mean by advanced life support and what the difference is in the training of the crews.
Sure. All Portland firefighters are EMT basics. So we all have a certification with the state of Oregon to provide, I don't want to use the word advanced, but certainly a lot of medical expertise for first aid and more advanced, setting up IV bags, utilizing a life pack or a defibrillator, and providing trauma care or assessing blood sugar, doing a lot of kind of basic first aid or advanced first aid. The paramedic actually has much more technical skills, and I should just turn it over to a paramedic to describe those skills. So,
I think our EMT, emergency medical technician, again, has the basic CPR and first aid. Paramedics have the ability to intubate, which is securing an airway in someone who is in cardiac arrest. They have a very wide selection of medications that can be given on scene. They have medications that would, at times, would be used in those to paralyze someone to secure their airway in a trauma where someone isn't being able to protect their own airway and is combative from a head injury. So our paramedics are very highly trained, and I'd probably ask Dr. Ju if you wanted to add any to that. But that's a brief. Really proud of our paramedic training, our paramedics and the care that they provide.
I have really nothing much to add more than that. I think there are two.
I think there are two parameters that the paramedics really give to the system. One of them is the early diagnosis.
In particular, early heart attacks as well as early stroke and early identification of traumatic patients here as well. There are some life-saving interventions, both procedure as well as medications that the paramedics can give. And also, they also are connected regarding the advanced triage and diagnostics, ability to detect a stroke, ability to detect a head injury, ability to detect a heart attack, and things like that. So those are the areas where the paramedic really adds to the medical quality of the call as well.
38 of 42. And we have one, we staff very efficiently, so we have one paramedic and then they're supported by three EMT basics. So programs.
That just occurs to me, is it the same 30 some crews that always have the paramedic 24/7?
Yes, generally.
And yeah. How is that assigned right now as to who gets, which areas of the city have a paramedic and which ones don't?
All areas have a paramedic. Some of our stations are double companies and some of the second unit to respond. So we always have an advanced life support unit from every station. Yep. So I talked about the Innovation Fund, the telemedicine, the partnership with AMR, and I'm going to turn it over actually to Chief Burns and Dr. Ju to talk, because they've done an enormous amount of research on the other programs while we've discussed them. I think they can discuss these other programs more articulately.
Yeah, what I'll do is just kind of explain some of the concepts and what some of the work that's been done so far. So the alternative destination, the primary care, that kind of builds on ADAT2. ADAT2, if a person meets the medical criteria, they're going to go to a clinic. The next phase and evolution of that is partnering with the clinic to pre-identify patients and work together with their primary care physician, with Multnomah County, and determine a community care plan. So before the call happens, that individual already knows what care will be provided to them. And often this does breach over into the frequent, the high utilizer group, so that we have a consistent care plan. We won't get repeated chest x-rays because everybody knows what their chest x-ray has been in the past 5 years. So that is an opportunity to really directly impact the cost savings of a hospital or a clinic if we can predetermine, with the patient's consent, of course, of their proper care that would be provided if they present in a similar manner each time. So that's the alternative destination with the community care plan. The hospital readmission reduction program is partnering, again, directly with providers. In essence, there's programs right now that identify congestive heart failure, COPD, and diabetes. And these are areas that Medicaid has looked at with the providers and the hospitals and are determining that a readmission within 30 days of being discharged is not in the best interest of a patient. So there's opportunities to partner with those facilities, those entities, to go to a person's home within 24 hours of being discharged. It would be a scheduled visit. During that visit, we would ensure that the person understood their discharge information, make sure they understand the medications that they were given, and in some cases reconcile old medication to new medication, as well as look at their general living conditions and really set them up for success to not be readmitted to the hospital. And then the third one, the home and facility care, we do have some high utilizer facilities, not necessarily a direct person. So in that concept, we would schedule one of our units to go to that facility, say Tuesday at 2 o'clock, and to kind of check in with the management of that facility of people who might need our services. Kind of a home health care paramedic would go in and say, you know, these we've came to this address 200 times in the last year for various people. So we had set up a system to partner with that facility. And so that's kind of an overview of the of those three.
Why would we be doing that rather than a healthcare provider?
Well, in the long run, some of those facilities, they are insured individuals. So there is a potential cost share, because otherwise that person may be calling 911 at 2 o'clock in the morning and we don't have the resources. Even the clinics that we're partnering with, they don't have the capacity, the hours after hours. So if we can identify a potential patient that we've established a history with and help with their community care plan in a proactive manner, it will ultimately reduce the calls for 911.
I understand that concept, but I'm wondering why it would be firefighters who would be providing that service rather than, say, Legacy sending somebody there at 2 o'clock on the afternoon to figure out why they're having so many 911 calls.
Could also be about our proximity and our ability to respond more quickly versus Legacy having extra staffing on duty.
Mm-hmm. And some of it, quite frankly, I kind of think I know where you're looking at. But we have the unique ability to be available after hours and on weekends, and so I think our flexibility to partner could a hospital provide that same service? Yeah, and they could, but I think for us to engage the concept and show proof of concept of why it's good for the community is what will get this these processes moving.
I'm sorry, I still don't understand why. I totally get that the hospital doesn't have somebody to send at midnight on Saturday, but if you're doing a scheduled visit to talk with the management, why isn't that the responsibility of a healthcare provider rather than firefighter?
I will tell you that both are entering those fields. There are fire departments doing it, and there are providers doing it. And I think it's going to be who can do it for less without affecting their other responsibilities. So can we do it, and can Portland Fire and Rescue participate in it and not have it negatively impact the other services, other services we provide while receiving some type of reimbursement for it versus having, so maybe the provider says, we'd rather pay you to do it than do it ourselves.
But we're not skilled at ongoing care. We're not, so our expertise is in emergency medical response. So how are our staff going to a facility to look at all of the factors that might be leading into 200 calls? How are we going to why are we the right people to do that?
Sure. So actually, I went to a symposium several months ago back at the National Fire Academy, and there were numerous private entities that came in to present on this topic itself. And what they found was that fire departments are received better, fire personnel are received better in the field. They generally are, they're used to working with people in the field. People are more, and they have an enormous amount of well-rounded knowledge to deal with injury prevention, assessing the home for different potential things that can cause harm to the individual, as well as the medical conditions. And these paramedics, they would be paramedics, they would be trained to a little bit higher level called a community paramedic. So it's not just emergency medicine, it's really about that holistic package. Mm-hmm. And John or Ken, can you speak to the community medic concept?
Yes, I think the commissioner really says the right things. Number one, it is a business model, which you're really talking about. There's nothing preventing the hospital or medical provider system putting people out in the field. But if you think about it, right now a mid-level provider sees 3 to 4 patients per hour, and that is all completely reimbursable. If you have a mid-level provider waiting for the call, they are not being reimbursed hardly anything while they're really waiting. So you really need to look at the cost and a business model of actually deploying that model. It may be. There's nothing that prevents the city of Portland from engaging a collaborative mutual response where you put a, I'm going to pick on it, Kaiser mid-level, and deploy it in a county car with a Portland fire paramedic. So if you look at a lot of EMS systems, it's not EMS completely. It is out-of-hospital care, mobile health care, which Randy really knows a lot about. And the mobile health care and emergency medical systems overlap. They don't are necessarily enjoined. But the problem that occurs is if you have staffing, it always helps to have dual trained people. Some of them can respond to emergencies if they actually come on, and they, some of them are scheduled appointments as well. So without being too granular, there are a lot of systems that are looking at the most cost-effective place to provide that health care, and it includes deployment in the field. The problem with deployment in the field is that you need to have a dispatch system, you need to have a radio system, you need to have 24/7 dispatchers to do that, and you need to have a car, and you need to have safety when you actually make entry as well. So those are all operational issues.
So perhaps could you give me some examples of the 200 calls to a particular facility? What kinds of problems were those calls addressing?
Actually, a variety of calls. Often, a good example would be someone who says that they have chest pain and they're short of breath, but when our crews come on scene, they actually need their medication refilled. And so those types of calls in those buildings, if we were proactive and said, hey, can we help you? Is there any issues? Scheduled appointments in their lobby, and quite frankly, this is actually already happening in one of our buildings where we're not the ones providing that care. Actually, a county nurse is. So the variety of calls, what we're dispatched to, and the variety of what we see on scene, they actually vary from actual true medical need at 2 o'clock in the morning, which is why we're here as a 911 system, to other less critical care.
Right. So then why is it having a firefighter go to have that scheduled meeting where you find out, the medication needs to be refilled? The firefighter doesn't have the authority to write that prescription. So you still, it seems like we're getting in the middle of, I agree that the community care concept and looking at what are the systemic problems in this facility, but it just doesn't seem like we're the, you could, excuse me, if there's a lot of falls, you can address the fact that, you know, there's no bed rails or there isn't a handrail on the stair, and that's a one-time fix. But in terms of the ongoing medical issues that people may be experiencing, the firefighter doesn't have the capacity, doesn't have the license to write those prescriptions or make that change in the care plan.
I think that's one of our challenges, if I may. One of our challenges is that we've been looked at as emergency providers, and we're really part of a community care concept that if we only talk and work on that person in an emergency setting, we go around in circles and in revolving door at times. And when I speak to clinics and healthcare programs, it is a challenge to get everybody on the same page that we're part of the patient care and we can ensure.
Yes, I think what we need to do, honestly, looking at me as myself in the mirror, is that we need to do a much better job in differentiating that call at 911. Okay, so let me be very clear. When you call 911, you either have an emergency, or you perceive having an emergency, or you need access to health care. There's a huge access to health care to our disadvantaged populations. There's also a huge access to health care issue for a behavioral health issue, which actually complicates the presentation as well as 911. Often a 911 caller is a third-party caller, which is the facility. They don't know the nuances of that area as well. So if you construct a system and you actually mistriage or don't have the details on the triage and the paramedic gets there, they say, I can't do anything, but let's call our mid-level who's in the field, and you need to come and write the prescription. That is how the flexible out-of-hospital care needs to occur. So the bottom line is that the 911 call taker doesn't have the nuances. In other words, it's not really the call taker. Our system is not set up to get that granularity of the call, and we need to do a better job in the call-taking side as well, not 911, like a medical call taking side.
I'm sorry to continue to flog this point, but the issue is about the scheduled visits, yeah. Which I get it, that firefighters are beloved, and perhaps the frequent caller might look forward to their 2 o'clock scheduled visit and not need to call on the previous Saturday to have somebody come out in an emergency.
Yeah.
On the issue of the facility needing some changes in its protocols, I have a relative who was in Buffalo during the snowstorm, and it came to pass that the facility that she's in, there's no, the meds are locked up, and they weren't able to get anybody into the facility to give the patients their meds. Well, it seems to me to be a problem that should be fixed on a systemic basis, and I would imagine that there may be some similar issues. Mm-hmm. Those are, I don't see that it's Portland Fire and Rescue's job to do that environmental assessment, that healthcare assessment. It's obviously in the healthcare provider's best interest to have somebody to go out to that facility, write the prescriptions on a regular basis, figure out why they're having so many high-intensity calls. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand why we're the right people to do those scheduled visits.
These are just things that we're looking at, so that it could be that your points are totally well taken, and we may not move forward on these items. These are not programs that are underway. Right. These are conversations that are being had, so I just want to make sure that we're clear on that.
Okay. Yes, All,
and that's all.
All points well taken. Thank you, Commissioner Fritz. Actually, I'd like to, Dr. Ju, could you elaborate on the nurse triage?
It sort of dovetails into what I was sort of talking about. I'm looking at Commissioner Novak right now because for obvious reasons. I believe there is a sweet spot for the nurse, the acronym's nurse 911, but it's probably nurse medical 911. If you look at the Kaiser model, it has a nurse triage line and a medical triage line with physicians there all the way through. So what's really happening is the following. Number one, our area is very well managed, and by that I mean Kaiser, Legacy, Ojasu, and Providence Systems have about 80 to 90% of the market. They have a very well entrenched nurse advice line in all the systems, including the county health nurses as well. So we believe that a nurse triage line is very viable in this area. That's number one. Number two, that all the providers are very interested in actually having some of the lower acuity calls be triaged to their nurse advice lines. Number three is how to design a nurse advice line system. And we believe that a initial triage, perhaps even at BOAC, that actually identifies the acuity of the call to provider if they have one, and then transfer that person to the provider nurse advice line would be the best fit right now. It is entirely possible in the next 6 to 12 months to try to pilot that concept, but it requires both funding as well as identification of the kinds of calls. Over the last 2 years, we've been identifying those calls, and we are close to being ready to hand off some of the 911 calls to that triage trunking line, and assuming our nurse advice lines are ready to receive that calls, that could be completely doable. And we're talking about up to 5% or 10% as max of the 911 calls.
And this, as Dr. Ju indicated, is something that we're pretty excited about. And it is a matter of saving money for the overall healthcare system, which I think is actually an economic development goal, because the lower healthcare costs are in the region, the more money is available for everything else. But it's something, responding to Commissioner Fritz's concerns, that we wouldn't want to lay out our own money to do. We'd be expecting the healthcare system, I mean, the providers to, and the insurers to pay us to do it. So the conversation we've had with them is, and actually Kaiser was particularly, has pushed this concept, is we'd have to change our protocols at BOAC, which would mean additional training, might mean adding some additional people. So we would expect the insurers/providers to pay for that. Dr. Ju would develop criteria for those calls. Ideally, what I would hope is that if we're able to save money for the insurers and providers, then we wouldn't just get reimbursed for the additional cost to us, but we'd share in some of the savings. Mm-hmm. But the potential savings are substantial. I mean, in Reno, they've implemented a nurse triage system, And since October 2013, they think that they've avoided 15,000 calls sent to nurse triage, and over 1,400 emergency department visits have been avoided. I think there's various ways we can do this. I mean, one way, as Dr. Ju said, is that we could simply forward people to the nurse lines that already exist with the existing insurers and providers. Kaiser suggested some interest in exploring the possibility of the insurers and providers banding together to actually sort of embed some nurse triage people within BOAC, maybe not physically, but I mean, sort of just have them collectively fund a separate line. But this is something that we're all very interested in, and it's, I mean, in other jurisdictions, the providers and insurers have seen the value of it and have paid the 911 systems in order to adapt to it.
Excellent. Thank you. And again, now, thank you, Commissioner Novick, for setting up the next slide. So, in conclusion, we believe that the programs that not only are underway, but many of the programs that we're looking at and at least researching or investigating can potentially provide a lot of benefit to the city and the residents and ultimately downstream, because the more money people save and have in their pocket, the more money they can spend elsewhere. And we recognize through the equity lens that people who are lower income are more dramatically impacted by health care costs and quickly become overwhelmed by those. So it's also a real equity issue. And the focus on preventative care and alternative treatment options really improves health care outcomes and reduce costs. So both are our focus. We believe this is a win-win for both patients, Portland Fire and Rescue, city residents, insurers, providers, and supports public and private partnerships. And as Commissioner Novick said, we believe that there's significant opportunity for cost sharing back to the city with these programs. So we're open to any and all questions you have.
Did you say you were going to talk about mental health?
I've got some questions about mental health, so maybe I can get them to do that. But maybe first some questions about technology. I'm just curious in terms of watching best practices out there on either the private ambulance side or the medical first responder side. We're going to authorize body cameras for our police officers tomorrow if the city council approves that item. Are we seeing the use of Google Glass or any similar technology by medical first responders out there around the country?
Certainly, and I'm going to turn that over to Dr. Ju because he is our technical, I won't call you a geek. But
yeah, absolutely. I think the mayor is absolutely correct. What you're actually seeing is the following, that telemedicine, which is what we're really talking about, either a mid-level, which is nurse practitioner or a PA or physician, or even just nurse, over the video camera, tele-video camera, is completely possible. Right now, the only thing that's really blocking us or stopping us is actually the HIPAA and the compliance, private confidentiality issue here as well. But that is overcomable, and almost all the systems, I can tell you, Legacy is doing this, Providence and Sisters are doing that, and so within the next 12 to 24 months, telemedicine is really part of the way of delivering health care, even through the assessment or actually meeting the needs of the patient without the patient going in. With that being said, the real question is, where is the city? The answer is the city is actually bringing the telemedicine to the bedside, and that's where the partnership is going to be at. So the medic would actually be in the room with Google Glass or even their iPad, and you put it on FaceTime secure, and the patient would be interviewed by the physician or the mid-level, and for obvious reasons, you can say, well, I need to see this patient, or I'm going to phone in a prescription. In fact, I have a pharmacist here. We're going to give you the prescription so you don't have to go out anywhere as well. That would be a cost saving, and the healthcare systems would readily, I think, pay for that to prevent a ED admission or hospitalization for that patient.
Excellent. Well, I guess I'm glad I got asked the question. I want to flag this issue. We've got legislative staff here in the room as well. We need to hear from the medical side as well as the police side at both the county and the city, what do we need to change in state law in order for us to even attempt to keep up with the technological change and bandwidth and capability that these devices have? And you know, session's going to start here in a couple of months. So if we're being blocked in part by need by antiquated state statute, this council and the county board of commissioners